Disc 2.
A heavy-set man emerges right behind her. They stand talking in the front yard, unaware that at that moment the TV cameraman has zoomed in on them. The man looks coarse and piggish with his sagging jowls and sparse strands of hair combed over a bare scalp. Beside him, she looks small and insubstantial. It has been a long time since I last saw her, and much about her seems changed. Oh, her hair is still an unruly mane of black curls, and she wears yet another one of her navy blue pantsuits, the jacket hanging too loose on her shoulders, the cut unflattering to her petite frame. But her face is different. Once it was square-jawed and confident, not particularly beautiful, but arresting nonetheless, because of the fierce intelligence of her eyes. Now she looks worn and troubled. She has lost weight. I see new shadows in her face and the hollows of her cheeks. Suddenly she spots the TV camera and she stares, looking straight at me, her eyes seeming to see me even as I see her, as though she stands before me in the flesh. We have a history together, she and I, a shared experience so intimate we are as forever bonded as lovers. I rise from the couch and walk to the TV, press my hand to the screen. I am not listening to the reporter's voiceover. I am focused only on her face. My little Janie, do your hands still trouble you? Do you still rub your palms the way you did in the courtroom, as though worrying at a splinter trapped in your flesh? Do you think of the scars the way I do, as love tokens, little reminders of my high regard for you? Get the fuck away from the TV, we can't see, someone yells. I do not move. I stand in front of the screen, touching her face, remembering how her cold, dark eyes once stared up at me in submission, remembering the slickness of her skin, perfect skin, unadorned by even the lightest stroke of the makeup brush. Asshole, move! Suddenly she is gone, vanished from the screen. The female newscaster in the jade-green jacket is back. Only a moment ago I had been content to settle for this well-groomed mannequin in my fantasies. Now she strikes me as vapid, just another pretty face, another slender throat. It took only one glimpse of Jane Rizzoli to remind me of what is truly worthy prey. I return to the couch and sit through a commercial for Lexus Automobiles, but I am no longer watching the TV. Instead, I am remembering what it was like to walk in freedom, to wander city streets inhaling the scents of women who pass by me, not the chemist's busy florals that come from bottles, but the real perfume of a woman's sweat or a woman's hair warmed by the sun. On summer days I would join the other pedestrians waiting for the crosswalk light to turn green. In the press of a crowded street corner, who would notice that the man behind you has leaned close to sniff your hair? Who would notice that the man beside you is staring at your neck, marking your pulse points, where he knows your skin smells sweetest? But they don't notice. The crosswalk light turns green, the crowd begins to move, and the woman walks on, never knowing, never suspecting that the hunter has caught her scent. The folding of the nightgown does not in itself mean you're dealing with a copycat, said Dr. Lawrence Zucker. This is merely a demonstration of control, the killer displaying his mastery over the victims, over the crime scene.
The way Warren Hoyt used to do, said Rizzoli.
Other killers have done this as well. It's not unique to the surgeon.
Dr. Zucker was watching her with a strange, almost feral glint in his eye. He was a criminal psychologist at Northeastern University, and he frequently consulted for the Boston Police Department. He had worked with the homicide unit during the surgeon investigation a year ago, and the criminal profile he'd compiled of the unknown subject at that time had turned out to be eerily accurate. Sometimes Rizzoli wondered how normal Zucker himself could be. Only a man intimately familiar with the territory of evil could have insinuated himself so deeply into the mind of a man like Warren Hoyt. She had never been comfortable with this man, whose sly, whispery voice and intense stares made her feel invaded and vulnerable. But he was one of the few who had truly understood Hoyt. Perhaps he would understand a copycat as well. Rizzoli said, "It's not just the folded nightclothes. There are other similarities. Duct tape was used to bind this victim.
Again, not unique. Did you ever watch the TV show MacGyver?
He showed us 1,001 uses for duct tape. Nocturnal entry through a window, the victim surprised in bed. When they're most vulnerable, it's a logical time of day to attack. And the single slash across the neck. Zucker shrugged.
A quiet and efficient way to kill.
But add it all together. The folded nightgown, the duct tape, the method of entry, the coup de grace.
And what you get is an unknown subject who is choosing rather common strategies. Even the teacup on the victim's lap. It's a variation on what's been done before by serial rapists. They set a plate or other dishes on the husband. If he moves, the falling chinaware alerts the perp. These are common strategies because they work.
In frustration, Rizzoli pulled out the Newton crime scene photos and laid them across his desk. We're trying to find a missing woman, Dr. Zucker. So far we have no leads. I don't even want to think about what she's going through right now, if she's still alive. So you take a good long look at these. Tell me about this unsub. Tell me how we can find him. How can we find her? Dr. Zucker slipped on his glasses and picked up the first photo. He said nothing, just stared for a moment, then reached for the next in the series of images. The only sounds were the creak of his leather chair and his occasional murmur of interest. Through his office window, Rizzoli could see the campus of Northeastern University nearly deserted on this summer's day. Only a few students were lolling on the grass outside, backpacks and books spread around them. She envied those students, envied their carefree days and their innocence, their blind faith in the future, and their nights, uninterrupted by dark dreams.
"You said you found semen?" said Dr. Zucker.
Reluctantly, she turned from the view of sunning students and looked at him. "Yes, on that oval rug in the photo. The lab confirms it's a different blood type from the husband's. The DNA's been entered into the CODIS database."
"Somehow I doubt this unsub is careless enough to be identified by a national database match. No, I'm betting his DNA isn't in CODIS."
Zucker looked up from the photo.
"And I'll bet he left no fingerprints."
"Nothing that popped up on APHIS. Unfortunately, the Yeagers had at least 50 visitors at the house following the funeral of Mrs. Yeager's mother, which means we're looking at a lot of unidentified prints." Zucker gazed down at the photo of Dr. Yeager slumped against the blood-splattered wall.
"This homicide was in Newton?"
"Yes."
"Not an investigation you'd normally take part in. Why are you involved?"
He looked up again, his gaze holding hers with discomforting intensity. "I was asked by Detective Corsack..."
"Who is nominally in charge, right?"
"Right, but..."
"Aren't there enough homicides in Boston to keep you busy, Detective? Why do you feel the need to take this on?"
She stared back, feeling as though he had somehow crawled inside her brain, that he was poking around searching for just the tender spot to torment. "I told you," she said. "The woman may still be alive."
"And you want to save her?"
"Don't you?" she shot back.
"I'm curious, Detective,"
said Zucker, unruffled by her anger.
"Have you talked to anyone about the Hoyt case? I mean, about its impact on you personally?"
"I'm not sure I know what you mean."
"Have you received any counseling?"
"Are you asking if I've seen a shrink?"
"It must have been a pretty awful experience, what happened to you in that basement. Warren Hoyt did things to you that would haunt any cop. He left scars, both emotional and physical. Most people would have lingering trauma, flashbacks, nightmares, depression."
"The memories aren't any fun, but I can deal with them."
"That's always been your way, hasn't it? To tough it out, never complain."
"I bitch about things like everyone else."
"But never about anything that would make you look weak or vulnerable."
"I can't stand whiners. I refuse to be one myself."
"I'm not talking about whining. I'm talking about being honest enough to acknowledge you're having problems."
"What problems?"
"You tell me, Detective."
"No, you tell me, since you seem to think I'm all fucked up."
"I didn't say that."
"But you think that."
"You're the one who used the term fucked up. Is that how you feel?"
"Look, I came about that." She pointed to the Yeager crime scene photos. "Why are we talking about me?"
"Because when you look at these photos, all you see is Warren Hoyt. I'm just wondering why."
"That case is closed. I've moved on."
"Have you, really?"
The question, asked so softly, made her fall silent. She resented his probing, resented most of all that he'd recognized a truth she could not admit. Warren Hoyt had left scars. All she had to do was look down at her hands to be reminded of the damage he'd inflicted. But the worst damage was not physical. What she had lost in that dark basement last summer was her sense of invincibility, her sense of confidence. Warren Hoyt had taught her how vulnerable she really was. "I'm not here to talk about Warren Hoyt," she said.
"Yet he's the reason you're here."
"No. I'm here because I see parallels between these two killers. I'm not the only one who does. Detective Korsak sees it too. So let's stick to the subject, okay?" He regarded her with a bland smile.
"Okay."
"So what about this unsub?" She tapped on the photos. "What can you tell me about him?" Once again, Zucker focused on the image of Dr. Yeager.
"Your unknown subject is obviously organized, but you already know that. He came to the scene fully prepared. The glass cutter, the stun gun, the duct tape. He managed to subdue this couple so quickly it makes you wonder."
He glanced at her.
"No chance there's a second perp, a partner?"
"Only one set of footprints."
"Then your boy is very efficient and meticulous."
"But he left his semen on the rug. He's handed us the key to his identity. That's one hell of a mistake."
"Yes, it is, and he certainly knows it."
"So why assault her right there in the house? Why not do it later in a safe place? If he's organized enough to pull off a home invasion and control the husband..."
"Maybe that's the real payoff."
"What?"
"Think about it. Dr. Yeager sits there, bound and helpless, forced to watch while another man takes possession of his property."
"Property," she repeated.
"In this unsub's mind, that's what the woman is, another man's property. Most sexual predators wouldn't risk attacking a couple. They'd choose the lone woman, the easy target. Having a man in the picture makes it dangerous. Yet this unsub had to know there was a husband in the picture, and he came prepared to deal with him. Could it be that was part of the pleasure, part of the excitement, that he had an audience?"
"An audience of one." She looked down at the photo of Richard Yeager slumped against the wall. Yes, that had been her immediate impression when she'd walked into the family room. Zucker's gaze shifted to the window. A moment passed. When he spoke again, his voice was soft and sleepy, as though the words were drifting up in a dream state.
"It's all about power and control, about dominance over another human being, not just the woman, but over the man as well. Maybe it's really the man who excites him, who's a vital part of this fantasy. Our unsub knows the risks, yet he's compelled to carry out his impulses. His fantasies control him, and he in turn controls his victims. He's all-powerful, the dominator. His enemy sits immobilized and helpless, and our unsub does what victorious armies have always done. He's captured his prize. He rapes the woman. His pleasure is heightened by Dr. Yeager's utter defeat. This attack is more than sexual aggression. It's a display of masculine power. One man's victory over another. The conqueror claiming his spoils."
Outside, the students on the lawn were gathering up their backpacks, brushing grass from their clothes. The afternoon sun washed everything in hazy gold. And what would the day hold next for those students, Rizzoli wondered. Perhaps an evening of leisure and conversation, pizza and beer, and a sound sleep without nightmares. The sleep of the innocent. "Something I'll never again know." Her cell phone chirped. "Excuse me," she said, and flipped open the phone. The call was from Aaron Volchko in the Hair and Fiber Lab. "I've examined those strips of duct tape taken off Dr. Yeager's body," said Aaron. "I've already faxed the report to Detective Korsak, but I knew you'd want to know as well."
"What have we got?"
"A number of short brown hairs caught in the adhesive. Limb hairs, pulled from the victim when the tape was peeled off."
"Fibers?"
"Those as well. But here's the real interesting thing. On the strip pulled from the victim's ankles, there was a single dark brown hair strand, 21 centimeters long."
"His wife is a blonde."
"I know. That's what makes this particular strand interesting." The unsub, thought Rizzoli. It's from our killer. She asked, Are there epithelial cells?
Yes.
So we might be able to get DNA off that hair strand. If it matches the semen.
It won't match the semen.
How do you know that?
Because there's no way this strand came from the killer.
Aaron paused.
Unless he's a zombie.
Chapter 4. For detectives in Boston PD's homicide unit, a visit to the crime lab required only a short walk down a pleasantly sun-washed hallway to the south wing of Schroeder Plaza. Rizzoli had strode down this hall countless times, her gaze often straying to the windows which overlooked the troubled neighborhood of Roxbury, where shops were barricaded at night behind bars and padlocks, and every parked car came equipped with the club. But today she was in single-minded pursuit of answers, and she did not even glance sideways, but headed in a beeline to room S-269, the hair fiber and trace evidence lab. In this windowless room, crammed tight with microscopes and a Gammatech prism gas chromatograph, criminalist Aaron Volchko reigned supreme. Cut off from sunlight and outdoor views, she focused her gaze instead on the world beneath her microscope lens, and she had the pinched eyes, the perpetual squint of someone who has been staring too long into an eyepiece. As Rizzoli came into the room, Aaron swiveled around to face her.
I've just put it under the microscope for you. Take a look.
Rizzoli sat down and peered into the teaching eyepiece. She saw a hair shaft stretched horizontally across the field.
This is that long brown strand I recovered from the strip of duct tape binding Dr. Yeager's ankles, said Aaron. It's the only such strand trapped in the adhesive. The others were short hairs from the victim's limbs, plus one of the Vic's head hairs on the strip taken from his mouth. But this long one is an orphan strand, and it's quite a puzzling one. It doesn't match either the victim's head hair or the hairs we got from the wife's hairbrush.
Rizzoli moved the field, scanning the hair shaft.
It's definitely human? Yes, it's human.
So why can't it be our perps?
Look at it. Tell me what you see.
Rizzoli paused, calling back to mind all that she had learned about forensic hair examination. She knew Aaron must have a reason for taking her so systematically through the process. She could hear quiet excitement in her voice. This strand is curved, degree of curl about 0.1 or 0.2, and you said the shaft length was 21 centimeters.
In the range of a woman's hairstyle, said Aaron, but rather long for a man.
Is it the length that concerns you?
No, length doesn't tell us gender.
Then what am I supposed to focus on anyway?
The proximal end, the root. Do you notice anything strange?
The root end looks a little ragged, kind of like a brush.
That's exactly the word I would use. We call that a brush-like root end. It's a collection of cortical fibrils. By examining the root, we can tell what stage of hair growth this strand was in. Care to venture a guess?
Rizzoli focused on the bulbous root end with its gossamer-like sheath.
There's something transparent clinging to the root.
An epithelial cell, said Aaron. That means it was in active growth.
Yes, the root itself is slightly enlarged, so this hair was in late anagen. It was just ending its active growth phase, and that epithelial cell might give us DNA.
Rizzoli raised her head and looked at Aaron. I don't see what this has to do with zombies. Aaron gave a soft laugh.
I didn't mean that literally.
What did you mean?
Look at the hair shaft again. Follow it as it leads away from the root.
Once again, Rizzoli gazed into the microscope and focused on a darker segment of the hair shaft. The color's not uniform, she said. Go on. There's a black band on the shaft a short way from the root. What is that?
It's called distal root banding, said Aaron. That's where the sebaceous gland duct enters the follicle. Sebaceous gland secretions include enzymes which actually break down cells in a sort of digestive process. It causes this swelling and dark band formation near the root end of the hair. That's what I wanted you to see, the distal banding. It rules out any possibility this hair is your unsub's. It may have been shed from his clothes, but not from his head.
Why not?
Distal banding and brush-like root ends are both post-mortem changes.
Rizzoli's head snapped up. She stared at Aaron.
Post-mortem? That's right. It came from a decomposing scalp. The changes in that strand are classic, and they're pretty specific for the decomposition process. Unless your killer has risen from the grave, this hair could not have come from his head.
It took a moment for Rizzoli to find her voice again.
How long would the person have to be dead for the hair to show these changes? Unfortunately, banding changes aren't helpful in determining the postmortem interval. It could have been pulled from the deceased's scalp anywhere from 8 hours to several weeks after death. Hair from corpses embalmed years ago could also look like this.
What if you pull someone's hair out while they're still alive, leave those hairs lying around for a while, would the changes show up then?
No. These decompositional changes only appear while the hair remains in the dead victim's scalp. They have to be plucked out later, after death.
Aaron met Rizzoli's stunned gaze.
Your unknown subject has had contact with a corpse. He picked up that hair on his clothes, then shed it onto the tape while he was binding Dr. Yeager's ankles.
Rizzoli said softly, "He has another victim."
"That's one possibility. I'd like to propose another."
Aaron crossed to another countertop and returned with a small tray bearing a section of duct tape lying adhesive side up.
"This piece was peeled off Dr. Yeager's wrists. I want to show it to you under UV. Hit that wall switch, will you?"
Rizzoli flipped the switch. In the sudden darkness, Aaron's small UV lamp glowed an eerie blue-green. It was a far less powerful light source than the crime scope that Mick had used in the Yeager residence, but as its beam washed across the strip of tape, startling details were nonetheless revealed. Adhesive tape left behind at crime scenes can be a detective's treasure trove. Fibers, hairs, fingerprints, even a criminal's DNA left behind in skin cells may adhere to tape. Under UV, Rizzoli could now see bits of dust and a few short hairs, and along one edge of the tape, what looked like a very fine fringe of fibers.
"Do you see how these fibers at the extreme edge are continuous?" said Aaron. "They run the whole length of the tape, taken from his wrists as well as from his ankles. They almost look like a manufacturer's artifact."
"But they're not."
"No, they're not. If you laid a roll of tape on its side, the edges pick up traces of whatever the roll is lying on. These are fibers from that surface. Wherever we go, we pick up traces of our environment, and later leave behind those traces in other locations. So has your unsub."
Aaron switched on the room lights, and Rizzoli blinked in the sudden glare. "What sort of fibers are these?"
"I'll show you."
Aaron removed the slide containing the strand of hair and replaced it with another slide.
"Take a look through the teaching head. I'll explain what we're seeing."
Rizzoli peered into the eyepiece and saw a dark fiber curled into a C.
"This is from the edge of the duct tape," said Aaron. "I used forced hot air to peel apart all the various layers of the tape. These dark blue fibers ran along the entire length. Now let me show you the cross-section."
Aaron reached for a file folder from which she removed a photograph.
"This is how it looks under the scanning electron microscope. See how the fiber has a delta shape? Like a little triangle. It's manufactured this way to reduce dirt trapping. This delta shape is characteristic of carpet fibers."
"So this is man-made material?"
"Right."
"What about birefringence?" Rizzoli knew that when light passed through a synthetic fiber, it often came out polarized in two different planes, as though shining through a crystal. The double refraction was called birefringence. Each type of fiber had a characteristic index, which could be measured with a polarizing microscope.
"This particular blue fiber," said Aaron, "has a birefringence index of 0.063.
"Is that characteristic for something in particular?"
"Nylon 6-6. Commonly used in carpets because it's resistant to stains, it's resilient, and it's tough. In particular, this fiber's cross-sectional shape and infrared spectrograph match a DuPont product called Antron, used in carpet manufacture."
"And it's dark blue," said Rizzoli. "That's not a color most people would choose for a home. It sounds like auto carpet." Aaron nodded.
"In fact, this particular color, number 802 blue, has long been offered as a standard option in luxury-priced American cars, Cadillacs and Lincolns, for instance."
Rizzoli immediately understood where this was going. She said,
"Cadillac makes hearses."
Aaron smiled.
"So does Lincoln."
They were both thinking the same thing. The killer is someone who works with corpses. She considered all the people who might come into contact with the dead— the cop and the medical examiner who are called to the scene of an unattended death, the pathologist and his assistant, the embalmer and the funeral director, the restorer who washes the hair and applies makeup so the loved one is presentable for final viewing. The dead pass through a succession of living guardians, and traces of this passage might cling to any and all who have laid hands on the deceased. She looked at Aaron. The missing woman, Gail Yeager.
What about her?
Her mother died last month. Joey Valentine was making the dead come alive. Rizzoli and Corsack stood in the brightly lit prep room of the Whitney Funeral Home and Chapel and watched as Joey dug through his Graftobian makeup kit. Inside were tiny jars of cream highlighters and rouges and lipstick powders. It looked like any theatrical makeup kit, except that these creams and rouges were meant to breathe life into the ashen skin of corpses. Elvis Presley's velvet voice sang "Love Me Tender" on a boombox, while Joey pressed modeling wax into the corpse's hands, plugging the various holes and incisions left by multiple IV catheters and arterial cutdowns.
This was Mrs. Ober's favorite music, he said as he worked, glancing occasionally at the three snapshots clipped to the easel, which he'd set up beside the prep table.
Rizzoli assumed they were images of Mrs. Ober, although the living woman who appeared in those photos bore little resemblance to the gray and wasted corpse on which Joey was now laboring.
Son says she's an Elvis freak, said Joey. Went to Graceland 3 times. He brought over that cassette so I could play it while I do her makeup. I always try to play their favorite song or tune, you know. Helps me get a feeling for them. You learn a lot about someone just by what music they listen to.
What's an Elvis fan supposed to look like?
Asked Corsack.
You know, brighter lipstick, bigger hair. Nothing like someone who listens to, say, Shostakovich.
So what music did Mrs. Hollowell listen to?
I don't really remember.
You worked on her only a month ago.
Yes, but I don't always remember the details.
Joey had finished his wax job on the hands. Now he moved to the head of the table, where he stood nodding to the beat of You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. Dressed in black jeans and Doc Martens, he looked like a hip young artist contemplating a black canvas. But his canvas was cold flesh, and his medium was the makeup brush and the rouge pot.
Touch of bronze blush light, I think,
he said, and reached for the appropriate jar of rouge. With a mixing spatula, he began blending colors on a stainless steel palette.
Yeah, this looks about right for an old Elvis girl.
He began smoothing it onto the corpse's cheeks, blending it all the way up to the hairline, where silver roots peaked beneath the black dye job. Maybe you remember talking to Mrs. Hollowell's daughter, said Rizzoli. She pulled out a photo of Gail Yeager and showed it to Joey.
You should ask Mr. Whitney. He handles most of the arrangements here. I'm just his assistant.
But you and Mrs. Yeager must have discussed her mother's makeup for the funeral, since you prepared the remains. Joey's gaze lingered on Gail Yeager's photograph.
I remember she was a really nice lady, he said softly.
Rizzoli gave him a questioning look.
Was?
Look, I've been following the news. You don't really think Mrs. Yeager's still alive, do you?
Joey turned and frowned at Corsack, who was wandering around the prep room, peeking into cabinets.
Detective, are you looking for something in particular?
No, just wondered what kind of stuff you keep in the mortuary.
He reached into one of the cabinets.
Hey, is this thing a curling iron?
Yes. We do shampoos and waves, manicures, everything to make our clients look their best.
I hear you're pretty good at it.
They've all been satisfied with my work.
Corsack laughed.
They can tell you that themselves, huh?
I mean their families. Their families are satisfied.
Corsack put down the curling iron.
You've been working for Mr. Whitney, what, 7 years now?
About that.
Must have been right out of high school.
I started off washing his hearses, cleaning the prep room, answering the night calls for pickup. Then Mr. Whitney had me help him with the embalming. Now that he's getting on in years, I do almost everything here.
So I guess you got an embalmer's license, huh?
A pause.
No, I never got around to applying. I just helped Mr. Whitney.
Why don't you apply? Seems like it'd be a step up.
I'm happy with my job the way it is.
Joey turned his attention back to Mrs. Ober, whose face had now taken on a rosy glow. He reached for an eyebrow comb and began to stroke brown coloring onto her gray eyebrows, his hands working with almost loving delicacy. At an age when most young men are eager to tackle life, Joey Valentine had chosen instead to spend his days with the dead. He had shepherded corpses from hospitals and nursing homes to this clean, bright room. He had washed and dried them, shampooed their hair, brushed on creams and powders to grant them the illusion of life. As he stroked color on Mrs. Ober's cheeks, he murmured,
"Nice. Oh, yes, that's really nice. You're going to look fabulous."
"So, Joey,"
said Corsack,
"you've been working here 7 years, right?"
"Didn't I just tell you that?"
"And you never bothered to apply for any, like, professional credentials?"
"Why do you keep asking me that?"
"Is that because you knew you wouldn't get a license?"
Joey froze, his hand about to stroke on lipstick. He said nothing.
"Does old Mr. Whitney know about your criminal record?"
asked Corsack. At last, Joey looked up.
"You didn't tell him, did you?"
"Maybe I should, seeing as how you scared the shit out of that poor girl."
"I was only 18. It was a mistake."
"A mistake? What, you peeped in the wrong window? Spied on the wrong girl?"
"We went to high school together. It wasn't like I didn't know her."
"So you only peep in windows of girls you know? What else you done you never got caught for?"
"I told you it was a mistake."
"You ever sneak into someone's house? Go into their bedroom, maybe filter a little something like a bra or a nice pair of panties?"
"Oh, Jesus."
Joey stared down at the lipstick he'd just dropped on the floor. He looked as though he was about to be sick.
"You know, peeping Toms have a bad way of going on to other things,"
said Corsack, unrelenting.
"Bad things."
Joey went to the boombox and shut it off. In the silence that followed, he stood with his back turned to them, staring out the window at the cemetery across the road.
"You're trying to fuck up my life."
"No, Joey, we're just trying to have a frank conversation here."
"Mr. Whitney doesn't know."
"And he doesn't have to, unless." "Where were you on Sunday night?"
"At home."
"By yourself?"
Joey sighed.
"Look, I know what this is all about. I know what you're trying to do, but I told you, I hardly knew Mrs. Yeager. All I did was take care of her mother. I did a good job, you know. Everyone told me so afterwards, how alive she looked."
"You mind if we take a peek in your car?"
"Why?"
"Just to check it out."
"Yes, I mind, but you're going to do it anyway, aren't you?"
"Only with your permission."
Corsack paused.
"You know, cooperation is a two-way street."
Joey just kept staring out the window.
"There's a burial out there today," he said softly. "See all the limousines? Ever since I was a kid, I've loved watching funeral processions. They're so beautiful, so dignified. It's the one thing people still do right. The one thing they haven't ruined. Not like weddings, where they do stupid things like jumping out of planes or saying their vows on national television. At funerals, we still show respect for what's proper."
"Your car, Joey."
At last, Joey turned and crossed to one of the cabinet drawers. Reaching inside, he pulled out a set of keys, which he handed to Corsack.
"It's the brown Honda."
Rizzoli and Corsack stood in the parking lot, staring down at the taupe carpet that lined the trunk of Joey Valentine's car.
"Shit!"
Corsack slammed down the trunk hood.
"I'm not through with this guy."
"You haven't got a thing on him."
"You see his shoes? Look to me like size 11. And the hearse has navy blue carpet."
"So do thousands of other cars. It doesn't make him your man."
"Well, it sure ain't old Whitney."
Joey's boss, Leon Whitney, was 66 years old.
"Look, we already got the unsub's DNA," said Corsack. "All we need is Joey's."
"You think he'll just spit in a cup for you?"
"If he wants to keep his job, I think he'll sit up and beg like a dog for me."
She looked across the road, shimmering with heat, and gazed at the cemetery where the funeral procession was now winding its dignified way toward the exit. Once the dead are buried, life moves on, she thought. Whatever the tragedy, life must always move on. And so should I. "I can't afford to spend any more time on this," she said.
"What?"
"I've got my own caseload, and I don't think the Yeager case has anything to do with Warren Hoyt."
"That's not what you thought 3 days ago."
"Well, I was wrong." She crossed the parking lot to her car, opened the door, and rolled down the windows. Waves of heat rushed out at her from the baking interior.
"Did I tick you off or something?"
he asked. "No."
"So why are you bailing out?"
She slid behind the wheel. The seat felt searing, even through her slacks. "I've spent the last year trying to get over the surgeon," she said. I've got to let go of him. I've got to stop seeing his hand in everything I run across.
You know, sometimes your gut feeling's the best thing you can go with.
Sometimes that's all it is. A feeling, not a fact. There's nothing sacred about a cop's instinct. What the hell is instinct, anyway? How many times does a hunch turn out dead wrong? She turned on the engine. Too damn often.
So, I didn't tick you off?
She slammed her door shut. No.
You sure?
She glanced through the open window at him. He stood squinting in the sunlight, eyes narrowed to slits under a bushy fringe of eyebrow. On his arms, dark hair is bristled, heavy as a pelt, and his stance, hips thrust forward, shoulders sagging, made her think of a slouching gorilla. No, he had not ticked her off. But she could not look at him without registering a twinge of distaste. "I just can't spend any more time on this," she said. "You know how it is." Back at her desk, she focused her attention on all the paperwork that had accumulated. On top was the file for Airplane Man, whose identity remained unknown and whose ruined body still lay unclaimed in the ME's office. She had neglected this victim too long, but even as she opened the folder and reviewed the autopsy photos, she was still thinking of the Jaegers and of a man who had corpse hair on his clothes. She reviewed the schedule of Logan Airport's jet landings and takeoffs, but it was Gail Jaeger's face that stayed on her mind, smiling from the photo on the dresser. She remembered the gallery of women's photos that had been taped to the wall of the conference room a year ago, during the surgeon investigation. Those women had been smiling, too, their faces captured at a moment when they were still warm flesh, when life still glowed in their eyes. She could not think of Gail Jaeger without remembering the dead who had gone before her. She wondered if Gail was already among them. Her pager vibrated, the buzz like an electric shock from her belt, an advance warning of a discovery that would rock her day. She picked up the phone. A moment later, she was hurrying out of the building. Chapter 5. The dog was a golden lab, excited to near hysteria by the police officer standing nearby. He capered and barked at the end of his leash, which was tied to a tree. The dog's owner, a wiry, middle-aged man in running shorts, sat nearby on a large rock, head drooping into his hands, ignoring his dog's pleading yips for attention.
"Owner's name is Paul Vandersloot. Lives on River Street, just a mile from here," said Patrolman Gregory Dowd, who had secured the scene and had already strung a semicircle of police tape on the trees.
They were standing on the edge of the municipal golf course, staring into the woods of Stony Brook Reservation, which directly abutted the golf course. Located at the southern tip of Boston's city limits, this reservation was surrounded by a sea of suburbs. But within Stony Brook's 475 acres was a rugged landscape of wooded hills and valleys, rocky outcroppings, and marshes fringed with cattails. In winter, cross-country skiers shushed along the park's 10 miles of trails. In summer, joggers found refuge in its quiet forests. And so had Mr. Vandersloot, until his dog led him to what lay among the trees.
"He says he comes here every afternoon to take his dog for a run," said Officer Dowd. "Usually goes up the East Boundary Road trail first, through the woods, then lopes back along this inside edge of the golf course. It's about a 4-mile run. Says he keeps the dog on a leash the whole time, but today the dog got away from him. They were going up the trail when it took off west into the woods and wouldn't come back. Vandersloot went chasing after him, practically tripped right over the body."
Dowd glanced at the jogger, who was still huddled on the rock.
"Called 911.
He use a cell phone?
No, ma'am. Went to a phone booth down at the Thompson Center. I got here around 2:20. I was careful not to touch anything. Just walked into the woods far enough to confirm it was a body. About 50 yards in, I could already smell it. Then after another 50 yards, I saw it. Backed right out and secured the scene. Closed off both ends of the Boundary Road trail."
"And when did everyone else get here?"
"Detective Sleeper and Crow got here around 3. The ME arrived around 3:30.
He paused.
"I didn't realize you were coming in, too.
Dr. Isles called me. I guess we're all parking on the golf course for now?"
"Detective Sleeper ordered it. Doesn't want any vehicles visible from Enneking Parkway. Keeps us out of the public's eye."
"Any media turned up yet?"
"No, ma'am. I was careful not to radio it in.
Use the call box down the road instead.
Good. Maybe we'll get lucky and they won't turn up at all.
Uh-oh, said Dowd. Could this be our first jackal arriving?
A dark blue marquee rolled across the golf course grass and pulled up beside the ME's van. A familiar, overweight figure hauled himself out and smoothed his sparse hair over his scalp.
He's not a reporter, said Rizzoli. This guy I'm expecting.
Corsack lumbered toward them.
You really think it's her?
He asked. Dr. Isles says it's a strong possibility. If so, your homicide just moved into Boston city limits. She looked at Dowd. Which way do we approach it so we don't contaminate things?
You're okay going from the east. Sleeper and Crow have already videoed the site. The footprints and drag marks all come from the other direction, starting at Enneking Parkway. Just follow your nose.
She and Corsack slipped under the police tape and headed into the woods. This section of second-growth trees was as dense as any deep forest. They ducked beneath spiky branches that scratched their faces and snagged their trouser legs on brambles. They emerged on the east boundary jogging trail and spotted a strand of police tape fluttering from a tree. The jogger was running along this path when his dog got away from him, she said. Looks like Sleeper left us a trail of tape. They crossed the jogging path and plunged once again into the woods.
Oh, man, I think I can smell it already, said Corsack.
Even before they saw the body, they heard the ominous hum of flies. Dry twigs snapped beneath their shoes, the sound as startling as gunfire. Through the trees ahead, they saw Sleeper and Crow, faces contorted in disgust as they waved away insects. Dr. Isles was crouched near the ground, a few diamonds of sunlight dappling her black hair. Drawing closer, they saw what Isles was doing. Corsack uttered an appalled groan.
Oh, shit, that I didn't need to see.
Vitreous potassium, said Isles, and the words sounded almost seductive in her smoky voice.
It'll give us another estimate for the post-mortem interval.
The time of death would be difficult to determine, Rizzoli thought, gazing down at the nude corpse. Isles had rolled it onto a sheet, and it lay face up, eyes bulging from the heat-expanded tissues inside the cranium. A necklace of disc-shaped bruises ringed the throat. The long blonde hair was a stiff mat of straw, the abdomen was bloated, and the belly was tinted a liverish green. Blood vessels had been stained by the bacterial breakdown of blood, and the veins were startlingly visible, like black rivers flowing beneath the skin. But all these horrors paled in view of the procedure Isles was now performing. The membranes around the human eye are the most sensitive surface of the body. A single eyelash or the tiniest grain of sand caught beneath an eyelid can cause immense discomfort. So it made both Rizzoli and Corsack wince to watch Isles pierce the corpse's eye with a 20-gauge needle. Slowly she sucked the vitreous fluid into a 10cc syringe.
"Looks nice and clear," said Isles, sounding pleased.
She placed the syringe in an ice-filled cooler, then rose to her feet and surveyed the site with a regal gaze.
"Liver temp is only 2 degrees cooler than ambient temp," she said, "and there's no insect or animal damage. She hasn't been lying here very long."
"It's just a dump?" asked Sleeper.
"Lividity indicates she died while lying face up. See how it's darker on the back where the blood's pooled? But she was found lying here face down."
"She was moved here?"
"Less than 24 hours ago."
"Looks like she's been dead a lot longer than that," said Crow.
"Yes, she's flaccid and there's significant bloating. Skin's already slipping off."
"Is that a nosebleed?" asked Corsack.
"Decomposed blood. She's starting to purge. Fluids are being forced out by the internal buildup of gases."
"Time of death?" asked Rizzoli. Isles paused, her gaze fixed for a moment on the grotesquely swollen remains of a woman they all believed was Gail Yeager. Flies buzzed, filling the silence with their greedy hum. Except for the long blonde hair, there was little about the corpse that resembled the woman in the photographs, a woman who once had surely turned men's heads with just a smile. It was a disturbing reminder that both the beautiful and the homely are reduced by bacteria and insects to the grim equality of moldering flesh.
"I can't answer that," said Isles. "Not yet."
"More than a day?" pressed Rizzoli.
"Yes."
"The abduction was Sunday night. Could she have been dead since then?"
4 days?
It depends on the ambient temperature. The absence of insect damage makes me think the body was kept indoors until just recently, protected from the environment. An air-conditioned room would slow down decomposition.
Rizzoli and Korsak exchanged glances, both of them wondering the same thing. Why would the unsub wait so long to dispose of a decomposing body? Detective Sleeper's walkie-talkie crackled, and they heard Dowd's voice.
Detective Frost just arrived, and the CSU van's here. You ready for him?
Stand by, said Sleeper.
Already he looked exhausted, drained from the heat. He was the oldest detective in the unit, no more than 5 years from retirement, and he had no need to prove himself. He looked at Rizzoli.
We're coming in on the tail end of this case. You've been working with Newton PD on it?
She nodded. Since Monday.
So you gonna be lead?
Right, said Rizzoli.
Hey, protested Crow. We were first on the scene.
Abduction was in Newton, said Korsak.
But the body's now in Boston, retorted Crow.
Jesus, said Sleeper. Why the hell are we fighting over this?
It's mine, said Rizzoli. I'm lead. She stared at Crow, daring him to challenge her. Expecting their usual rivalry to flare up, as it always did, she saw one side of his mouth turn up in the beginning of an ugly sneer. Then Sleeper said into his walkie-talkie,
Detective Rizzoli is now lead investigator.
He looked at her again.
You ready for CSU to come in?
She glanced up at the sky. It was already 5 p.m., and the sun had dipped below the trees. Let's get them in here while they can still see what they're doing. An outdoor death scene in fading daylight was not a scenario she welcomed. In wooded areas, wild animals were always poised to descend, scattering remains and dragging off evidence. Rainstorms wash away blood and semen, and the winds scatter fibers. There were no doors to lock out trespassers, and perimeters were easily breached by the curious. So she felt a sense of urgency as the crime scene unit began its grid search. They brought with them metal detectors and sharp eyes and evidence sacks waiting to be filled with grotesque treasures. By the time Rizzoli tramped back out of the woods and onto the golf course, she was sweating and filthy and tired of swatting at mosquitoes. She paused to brush twigs from hair and pluck burrs from her slacks. Straightening, she suddenly focused on a sandy-haired man in a suit and tie who stood beside the ME's van, a cell phone pressed to his ear. She went to Patrolman Dowd, who was still manning the perimeter. "Who's the suit over there?" she asked. Dowd glanced in the man's direction.
"Him? Says he's FBI."
"What?"
"Flashed his badge and tried to talk his way past me. I told him he'd have to clear it with you first. Didn't seem too happy about that."
"What's a fibby doing here?"
"You got me."
She stood watching the man for a moment, disturbed by the arrival of a federal agent. As lead investigator, she wanted no blurring of the lines of authority, and this man with his military bearing and businessman's suit already looked as though he owned the scene. She walked toward him, but he did not acknowledge her presence until she was standing right beside him. "Excuse me," she said. "I understand you're FBI?" He snapped his cell phone shut and turned to face her. She saw strong, clean-cut features and a coolly impervious gaze. "I'm Detective Jane Rizzoli, the lead on this case," she said. "May I see your ID?" He reached into his jacket and pulled out the badge. As she studied it, she could feel him watching her, sizing her up. She resented his silent appraisal, resented the way he put her on guard as though he was the one in control. "Agent Gabriel Dean," she said, handing back the badge.
"Yes, ma'am."
"May I ask what the FBI's doing here?"
"I wasn't aware we were on opposing teams."
"Did I say we were?"
"You're giving me the distinct feeling I shouldn't be here."
"The FBI doesn't usually turn up at our crime scenes. I'm just curious what brings you to this one."
"We received an advisory from Newton PD about the Yeager homicide."
It was an incomplete answer. He was leaving out too much, forcing her to fish. Withholding information was a form of power, and she understood the game he was playing. "I imagine you guys get a lot of routine advisories," she said.
"Yes, we do."
"Every homicide, isn't that right?"
"We're notified."
"Is there something about this one that's special?" He simply gazed at her with that impenetrable expression.
"I think the victims would say so."
Her anger was working its way like a splinter to the surface. "This body was found only a few hours ago," she said. "Are these advisories now instantaneous?" There was a faint twitch of a smile on his lips.
"We're not entirely out of the loop, Detective. We'd appreciate it if you kept us apprised of your progress. Autopsy reports, trace evidence, copies of all witness statements.
That's a lot of paperwork."
"I realize that."
"And you want it all?"
"Yes."
"Any particular reason?"
"A murder and abduction shouldn't interest us. We'd like to follow this case."
As imposing as he was, she didn't hesitate to challenge him by stepping closer. "When do you plan to start calling the shots?"
"It remains your case. I'm only here to assist."
"Even if I don't see the need for it." His gaze shifted to the two attendants who'd emerged from the woods and were now loading the stretcher with the remains into the ME's van.
"Does it really matter who works the case?"
he asked quietly.
"As long as this unsub is caught?"
They watched the van drive away, carrying the already desecrated corpse to further indignities beneath the bright lights of the autopsy suite. Gabriel Dean's response had reminded her, with punishing clarity, just how unimportant were matters of jurisdiction. Gail Yeager did not care who took credit for the capture of her killer. All she demanded was justice, whoever might deliver it. Justice was what Rizzoli owed her. But she'd known the frustration of watching her own hard work claimed by her colleagues. More than once she had seen men step forward and arrogantly assume command of cases she herself had painstakingly built from scratch. She would not allow it to happen here. She said, "I appreciate the Bureau's offer of help, but at the moment I think we've got all bases covered. I'll let you know if we need you." After that, she turned and walked away.
"I'm not sure you understand the situation," he said. "We're part of the same team now."
"I don't recall asking for FBI assistance."
"It's been cleared through your unit commander, Lieutenant Marquette. Would you like to confirm it with him?"
He held out his cell phone. "I have my own cell phone. Thank you."
"Then I urge you to call him so we don't waste time on turf battles."
She was stunned by how easily he had stepped aboard, and by how accurately she had sized him up. This was a man who'd not stand quietly on the sidelines. She took out her own phone and began punching in numbers, but before Marquette answered, she heard Patrolman Dowd call out her name.
"Detective Sleeper's on come for you,"
said Dowd, and handed her his walkie-talkie. She pressed the transmit button. "Rizzoli." Through a burst of static, she heard Sleeper say,
"You might want to get back here."
"What have you got?"
You'd better see for yourself. We're about 50 yards north of where the other one was found."
"The other one?" She thrust the walkie-talkie back at Dowd and charged into the woods. She was in such a hurry she did not immediately notice that Gabriel Dean was following her. Only when she heard the snap of a twig did she turn and see that he was right behind her, his face grim and implacable. She didn't have the patience to argue with him, so she ignored him and plunged on. She spotted the men standing in a grim circle beneath the trees, like silent mourners with heads bowed. Sleeper turned and met her gaze.
"They had just finished their first sweep with the metal detector," he said. "Crime scene tech was heading back to the golf course when the alarm went off."
She moved into the circle of men and crouched down to inspect what they had found. The skull had been separated from the body, and it lay isolated from the rest of the nearly skeletonized remains. A gold crown glinted like a pirate's tooth from the row of dirt-stained teeth. She saw no clothing, no remnants of fabric, only exposed bones with leathery bits of decomposing flesh still adhering. Clumps of long brown hair were matted to leaves, suggesting that these remains were a woman's. She straightened, her gaze scanning the forest floor. Mosquitoes lit on her face and fed off her blood, but she was oblivious to their sting. She focused only on the layers of dead leaves and twigs, the dense underbrush. A deeply sylvan retreat that she now regarded with horror. How many women are lying in these woods?
It's his dump site.
She turned and looked at Gabriel Dean, who had just spoken. He was crouched a few feet away, sifting through the leaves with gloved hands. She had not even seen him pull on gloves. Now he stood up, his gaze meeting hers.
"Your unsub has used this place before," said Dean, "and he'll probably use it again.
If we don't scare him off."
"And that's the challenge, keeping it quiet."
If you don't alarm him, there's a chance he'll come back, not just to dump another body, but to visit, to recapture the thrill.
You're from the behavioral unit, aren't you? He didn't answer her question, but turned to survey the array of personnel standing around in the woods.
If we can keep this out of the press, we might have a chance, but we've got to clamp down on it now.
We? With that one word, he had stepped into a partnership with her that she had never sought, had never consented to. Yet here he was, issuing edicts. What made it especially galling was the fact that everyone else was listening to their conversation and understood that her authority was now being challenged. Only Korsak, with his customary bluntness, dared step into the dialogue.
"Excuse me, Detective Rizzoli," he said. "Who is this gentleman?"
"FBI," she said, her gaze still fixed on Dean.
"So could someone explain to me when this turned into a federal case?"
"It hasn't," she said, "and Agent Dean is about to leave the site. Could somebody show him the way?" She and Dean gazed at each other for a moment. Then he tipped his head to her, a silent acknowledgement that he was conceding this round.
"I can find my own way out," he said.
Then he turned and walked back toward the golf course.
"What is it with these fibbies?" said Korsak. "Always think they're king of the hill. What's the Bureau doing here?"
Rizzoli stared at the woods into which Gabriel Dean had just vanished, a gray figure blending into the dusk. "I wish I knew." Lieutenant Marquette arrived on the scene a half hour later. The presence of Brass was usually the last thing Rizzoli welcomed. She disliked having a superior officer look over her shoulder as she worked, but Marquette did not interfere and simply stood among the trees silently appraising the situation. "Lieutenant," she said. He responded with a curt nod.
"Rizzoli?"
"What's with the Bureau? They had an agent here, expecting full access." He nodded.
"Request came through OPC."
So it had been approved at the top, the office of the police commissioner. She watched as the CSU crew packed up their kits and headed back toward the van. Though they were standing within Boston city limits, this dark corner of Stony Brook Reservation felt as isolated as the deep woods. The wind tossed leaves into the air and stirred the smell of decay. Through the trees, she saw Barry Frost's flashlight bobbing in the darkness as he untied the crime scene tape, removing all traces of police activity. Tonight the stakeout would begin for an unsub whose craving for a whiff of decay might draw him back to this lonely park, to this silent grove of trees.
"So I don't have any choice," she said. "I have to cooperate with Agent Dean?"
"I assured OPC we would."
"What's the Bureau's interest in this case?"
"Did you ask Dean?"
"It's like talking to that tree over there. You get nothing back. I'm not thrilled about this. We have to give him everything, but he doesn't have to tell us squat."
"Maybe you didn't approach him the right way."
Anger shot like a poisoned dart into her bloodstream. She understood the unspoken meaning of his statement. "You've got an attitude, Rizzoli. You always tick off men."
"You ever met Agent Dean?" she asked.
"No."
She gave a laugh laced with sarcasm. "Lucky you."
"Look, I'll find out what I can. Just try to work with him, okay?"
"Does someone say I haven't?"
"Phone call says. I hear you chased him off the site. That's not exactly a cooperative relationship."
"He challenged my authority. I need to establish something right off the bat here. Am I in charge or am I not?" A pause.
"You're in charge."
"I trust Agent Dean will get that message, too."
"I'll see he does."
Marquette turned and stared at the woods.
"So, now we've got two sets of remains, both female?"
"Judging from the skeletal size and the clumps of hair, the second one looks like another female. There's almost no soft tissue left, post-mortem scavenger damage, but no obvious cause of death."
"Are we sure there aren't more of them out here?"
"Cadaver dogs didn't find any." Marquette gave a sigh.
"Thank God."
Her pager vibrated. She glanced down at her belt and recognized the phone number on the digital readout, the ME's office.
"It's just like last summer,"
murmured Marquette, still staring at the trees.
"The surgeon started killing around this time, too."
"It's the heat," said Rizzoli, as she reached for her cell phone. "It brings the monsters out."
Chapter 6. I hold freedom in the palm of my hand. It comes in the shape of a tiny white pentagon with MSD-97 stamped on one side. Decadron, 4 milligrams. Such a pretty shape for a pill. Not just another boring disc or torpedo-shaped caplet like so many other medicines. This design took a leap of imagination, a spark of whimsy. I picture the marketing folks at Merck Pharmaceutical sitting around a conference table asking each other, how can we make this tablet instantly recognizable? And the result is this five-sided pill which rests like a tiny jewel in my hand. I have been saving it, hiding it away in a small tear in my mattress, waiting for just the right time to use its magic, waiting for a sign. I sit curled up on the cot in my cell, a book propped up on my knees. The surveillance camera sees only a studious prisoner, reading the complete works of William Shakespeare. It cannot see through the cover of the book. It cannot see what I hold in my hand. Downstairs in the well of the day room, a commercial blares on the TV, and a ping-pong ball clacks back and forth on the table. Yet another exciting evening in cell block C. In an hour, the intercom will announce lights out, and the men will climb the stairs to their cells, shoes clanging on metal steps. They will each walk into their cages, obedient rats, minding their master in the squawk box. In the guard booth, the command will type into the computer, and all cell doors will simultaneously close, locking the rats in for the night. I curl forward, bending my head to the page, as though the print is too small. I stare with fierce concentration at Twelfth Night, Scene 3, a street, Antonio and Sebastian approaching. Nothing to watch here, my friends, just a man on his cot reading, a man who suddenly coughs and reflexively puts his hand to his mouth. The camera is blind to the small tablet in my palm. It does not see the flick of my tongue or the pill clinging to it like a bitter wafer as it's drawn into my mouth. I swallow the tablet dry, needing no water. It is small enough to go down easily. Even before it dissolves in my stomach, I imagine I can feel its power swirling through my bloodstream. Decadron is the brand name for dexamethasone, an adrenocortical steroid with profound effects on every organ in the body. Glucocorticoids such as Decadron affect everything from blood sugar to fluid retention to DNA synthesis. Without them, the body collapses. They help us maintain our blood pressure and stave off the shock of injury and infection. They affect our bone growth and fertility, muscle development and immunity. They alter the composition of our blood. When at last the cage doors slide shut and the lights go out, I lie on my cot feeling my blood pulse through me, imagining the cells as they tumble through my veins and arteries. I have seen blood cells numerous times through the microscope. I know the shape and function of each one, and with just a glance through the lens I can tell you if a blood smear is normal. I can scan a field and immediately estimate the percentages of different leukocytes, the white blood cells that defend us from infection. The test is called a white blood cell differential, and I have performed it countless times as a medical technician. I think of my own leukocytes circulating in my veins. At this very moment, my differential white count is changing. The tablet of Decadron, which I swallowed 2 hours ago, has by now dissolved in my stomach, and the hormone is swirling through my system, performing its magic. A blood sample drawn from my vein will reveal a startling abnormality, an overwhelming host of white blood cells with multilobed nuclei and granular stippling. These are neutrophils which automatically swarm into action when faced with the threat of overwhelming infection. When one hears hoofbeats, medical students are taught, one must think of horses, not zebras. But the doctor who sees my blood count will surely think of horses. He will arrive at a perfectly logical conclusion. It will not occur to him that this time it is truly a zebra galloping by. Rizzoli suited up in the autopsy suite's changing room, donning gown and shoe covers, gloves and a paper cap. She'd had no time to shower since tramping around Stony Brook Reservation, and in this overcooled room, sweat chilled like rime on her skin. Nor had she eaten dinner, and she was lightheaded with hunger. For the first time in her career, she considered using a tab of Vicks under her nose to block out the smells of the autopsy, but she resisted the temptation. Never before had she resorted to its use, because she'd thought it a sign of weakness. A homicide cop should be able to deal with every aspect of the job, however unpleasant. And while her colleagues might retreat behind a menthol shield, she had stubbornly endured the undisguised odors of the autopsy suite. She took a deep breath, inhaling a last gulp of unfouled air, and pushed through the door into the next room. She had expected to find Dr. Isles and Corsack waiting for her. What she had not expected was to find Gabriel Dean in the room as well. He stood across the table from her, a surgical gown covering his shirt and tie. While exhaustion showed plainly on Corsack's face and in the weary slump of his shoulders, Agent Dean looked neither tired nor bowed by the day's events. Only the 5 o'clock shadow darkening his jaw marred his crisp good looks. He regarded her with the unabashed gaze of one who knows he has every right to be there. Under the bright exam lights, the body looked in far worse shape than when she had seen it just hours ago. Purge fluid had continued to leak from the nose and mouth, trailing bloody streaks on the face. The abdomen was so bloated it appeared to be in the advanced stages of pregnancy. Fluid-filled blisters ballooned beneath the skin, lifting it from the dermis in papery sheets. Skin was peeling away entirely from areas of the torso and had bunched like wrinkled parchment under the breasts. Rizzoli noted that the finger pads had been inked. "You've already taken prints." "Just before you got here," said Dr. Isles, her attention focused on the tray of instruments that Yoshima had just wheeled to the table. The dead interested Isles more than the living did, and she was oblivious, as usual, to the emotional tensions vibrating in the room. "What about the hands, before you inked them?" Agent Dean said.
"We've completed the external exam. The skin's been sticky-taped for fibers, and the nail clippings have been collected."
"And when did you get here, Agent Dean?"
"He was here before me, too," said Corsack. "I guess some of us rate higher on the food chain."
If Corsack's comment was meant to feed her irritation, it worked. A victim's fingernails may harbor bits of skin clawed from the attacker. Hair or fibers may be clutched in a closed fist. The examination of the victim's hands was a crucial step in the autopsy, and she had missed it, but Dean had not.
"We already have a positive ID," said Isles. "Gail Yeager's dental X-rays are up on the light box."
Rizzoli crossed to the light box and studied the series of small films clipped there. Teeth glowed like a row of ghostly headstones on the film's black background.
"Mrs. Yeager's dentist did some crown work on her last year. You can see it there. The gold crown is number 20 on the periapical series. Also, she had silver amalgam fillings in numbers 3, 14, and 29.
"It's a match?" Dr. Isles nodded.
"I have no doubt these are the remains of Gail Yeager."
Rizzoli turned back to the body on the table, her gaze falling on the ring of bruises around the throat. "Did you X-ray the neck?"
"Yes. There are bilateral thyroid horn fractures, consistent with manual strangulation."
Isles turned to Yoshima, whose silent and ghostly efficiency sometimes made one forget he was even in the room.
"Let's get her into position for the vaginal swabs."
What followed next struck Rizzoli as the worst indignity that could befall a woman's mortal remains. It was worse than the gutting open of the belly, worse than the resection of heart and lungs. Yoshima maneuvered the flaccid legs into a frog-like position, spreading the thighs wide for the pelvic exam.
"Excuse me, detective," Yoshima said to Corsack, who was standing closest to Gail Yeager's left thigh. "Could you hold that leg in position?"
Corsack stared at him in horror.
"Me?"
"Just keep the knee flexed like that so we can collect the swabs."
Reluctantly, Corsack reached for the corpse's thigh, then jerked back as a layer of skin peeled off in his gloved hand.
"Christ, oh, Christ!"
"The skin's going to slip, no matter what you do. If you could just hold the leg open, okay?"
Corsack let out a sharp breath. Through the stench of the room, Rizzoli caught a whiff of Vicks menthol. Corsack, at least, had not been too proud to dab it on his upper lip. Grimacing, he grabbed the thigh and rotated it sideways, exposing her genitalia.
"Like this is gonna make sex real appealing from now on," he muttered.
Dr. Isles directed the exam light onto the perineum. Gently, she spread apart the swollen labia to reveal the introitus. Rizzoli, stoic as she was, could not bear to watch this grotesque invasion, and she turned away. Her gaze met Gabriel Dean's. Up till that moment, he had been observing the proceedings with quiet detachment, but at that instant she saw anger in his eyes. It was the same rage she now felt towards the man who had brought Gail Yeager to this ultimate degradation. Staring at each other in shared outrage, their rivalry was temporarily forgotten. Dr. Iles inserted a cotton swab into the vagina, smeared it across a microscope slide, and set the slide on a tray. Next, she took a rectal swab, which would also be analyzed for the presence of sperm. When she'd completed the collection and Gail Yeager's legs were once again lying straight on the table, Rizzoli felt as though the worst was over. Even as Iles started the Y incision, cutting diagonally from the right shoulder down to the lower end of the sternum, Rizzoli thought that nothing could surpass the indignity of what had already been done to this victim. Iles was just about to cut a matching incision from the left shoulder when Dean said,
"What about the vaginal smear?"
"The slides will go to the crime lab," said Dr. Iles.
"Aren't you going to do a wet prep?"
"The lab can identify sperm perfectly well on a dry slide."
"This is your only chance to examine the fresh specimen."
Dr. Iles paused, scalpel tip poised over the skin, and gave Dean a puzzled look. Then she said to Yoshima,
"Put a few drops of saline on that slide and slip it under the microscope. I'll take a look in just a second."
The abdominal incision came next, Dr. Iles's scalpel slicing into the bloated belly. The stench of decomposing organs was suddenly more than Rizzoli could bear. She lurched away and stood gagging over the sink, regretting that she had so foolishly tried to prove her own fortitude. She wondered if Agent Dean was watching her now and feeling any sense of superiority. She had not seen Vix glistening on his upper lip.
This book is continued on Disc 3.